Hello.
You're on with Nick and Fiona.
It's a lie. I mean, it basically is true, but it is also basically false.
Hello, and welcome to the playlist. My name is Nick Bassine. This is a very special episode. My co-host Fiona Williams and I got the chance to talk to the New York Times culture writer, Wesley Morris. He was out here for the Sydney Writers Festival. He's a super smart dude, knows a lot about movies, and we had a really interesting conversation with him about movies, the role of criticism in today's landscape, and just had a bunch of laughs as well. Here's our chat with Wesley Morris. Wesley Morris, thanks so much for being with us on the playlist.
Thanks for having me. It's nice to be here.
So, what was your introduction to watching movies? How did you develop your critical voice? How did it begin?
Oh, well, those are two different questions, really. I mean, they're very separate in my brain. I started watching movies more or less when I started watching them with the understanding that, oh, these questions are connected. If you play the game right. So I guess the short answer that connects both your questions, because you knew what you were asking, is that I got a book report assignment when I was in elementary, so middle school. And the assignment was to watch this movie called April Morning, which was a Hallmark Hall of Fame movie based on a novel. And we were supposed to read the novel and or watch the movie and write about one or the other. And I wrote about both because I had knowledge of both. And that was the first time I understood in doing that assignment the way that I did it, where I basically reviewed an adaptation of a book, a movie adaptation of a book. It was the first time I understood that you could watch something like a movie and assess its success as a work, and that the work had a value greater than the actual thing it is, or it could have a value greater than the thing that it is. And so I was encouraged by the teacher who gave that assignment to understand that criticism is a thing that people can get paid to do. Like it's an actual career, which I didn't know when I was doing that assignment. I took the person's advice and started doing film reviews. And over the course of those years of writing about movies, I just kind of figured out how I wanted to do it. I guess I'd have an answer for how that would go. But I mean, eventually I figured out what my priorities were as a critic and as a thinker.
Were there other people doing it in a way that you wanted to do it? Or did you come up with, like, how did you?
I definitely read a lot. When I was growing up, there was the internet. I mean, Al Gore would say there was an internet, but there was no internet the way we currently have the internet. So a lot of what I read was my local newspaper. I'm from Philadelphia. I had the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Daily News, and that was it. And I had Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel on television. I'd never read either one of those guys until maybe college. And so I didn't really have any models for how, I mean, I did. I had the local people to, and Peter Travers was the other person in Rolling Stone magazine. I liked how much space he had. And I now understand, I can now remember things that he would write that I would try to copy a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I'm mortified to think that I had been doing that. Not because Peter Travers is bad, just because we are so different in our approaches to our jobs. But when I was a kid, I really wanted to use as many, you know, adverb adjective combinations as humanly possible. I thought it would be good to write in a way that would ensure that what you write winds up on a poster. No disrespect to Mr. Travers. I'm sure that these decisions aren't necessarily made by the critics. They're hopefully never made by the critics. They're studio choices. But I knew that I wasn't any of those people, so I had to figure out how to be me. And when I got to college, I read a lot of theory. I went to Yale. I was a film studies major, and they teach you a lot of theory. Like, you don't read any criticism at all. So, you know, I'm very well versed in all kinds of literary and film theory concepts. They are somewhat useless in criticism. I don't know how you guys feel about the application of theory. I mean, theory is useful, but theory writing is not.
Yeah, right. I agree with that for sure.
So I had to figure out after college, undo that sort of paper writing style when it came to writing about movies. This is a long answer to your question, but it took a long time to figure out how to write in a style that was mine and not Pauline Kael's or Molly Haskell's or Andrew Saris's.
Right.
It took a long time. I definitely know how to write like myself without thinking about other people now, which is, you know, that took a long time.
How long does it take you to write a review?
Depends. Sometimes it could take you, I've done it in less than an hour, you know, like a 500 to 600 word review. I could, depending on what the thing is and how much time I have to do it, it can be done in an hour. Not ideal circumstances, but pretty good. You know, I can remember, like, do you remember that movie Drive Angry?
Yep.
Yeah.
That Nicolas Cage movie. I think I wrote a 500 word review of that movie in 35 minutes.
All about how great Nicolas Cage is.
No. I mean, at that point, I don't know what number that is in that phase of Nicolas Cage's demise.
Did you see the trailer for his new one?
No.
Oh, man.
What's,
I forget what it's called. One? God, I watched it yesterday. Sorry.
I mean, he did go through a phase of having to make a lot of movies.
That's his problem. Yeah. That should.
Oh, no, no,
we
I'm
should.
Not making
we
any
should
excuses.
Not. We should not have to put up with that because he has some tax issues.
Yes, exactly. No, I'm not making any.
It's taxes, it's, right? It's,
that's what. Yeah,
it wasn't. It wasn't alimony. It was taxes.
No, I think it was. Just
he had
bad
to sell. He sold
a
castle.
Or...
I think he had a castle that he needed to sell.
It's kind of amazing. We don't have National Treasure 6. Isn't it?
You would think. Just
I'm just
that
wondering
line,
now what this movie is that you saw a trailer for.
He is friends with a black teenager.
Oh, stop.
And I think the kid gets into some trouble.
Oh, stop. 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 Yeah. Stop. Stop. Anyway. Stop. Really? Are you making this up?
No.
Because you
watched
saying
it
all
yesterday.
The things to like push my buttons. This is exactly what I want Nicolas Cage to be doing so I can keep not liking him.
It looks like he's in his version where he's got more of a heart. So he's not...
He's helping the black teenager.
He's trying to be helpful.
Yes.
Rather than just unhinged.
Oh my God, I can't believe we're still making that movie. And that John Travolta, see, this is part of the problem, right? Because now they're like in the same boat, Travolta and Cage. The idea that Nicolas Cage now has to be Sandra Bullock in The Blind Side to get people to like him again is...
He wants another Oscar.
Ugh, God. Anyway... Go
anyway,
on.
We didn't come here to just ask you about Nicolas Cage movies.
You could. I could talk about him all day.
Well, I'm interested with your job. You know, you did start like pre-internet and whatnot, but now everyone has an opinion and they're very quick to give it. How has that changed what you do? Does it change what you do?
No. Actually, it does. It has changed a little bit. And what it's changed is the amount of time I feel I can take to write something, which is basically... all day. I mean, with film reviews, it's one thing. You typically write when the movie opens or not long after the movie opens. At the New York Times, you write before the movie opens. But I don't really do a lot of straight conventional film reviews anymore. So I really have the luxury of taking my time a little bit. But I notice, you know, in some of what you're responding to, some of what I'm responding to now when I'm writing some of these longer stories is what other people have already said and what the conversation is among a like certain classes of internet users, depending on what typically I just wind up on Twitter just because it's an easier place to aggregate sentiment. I think if anything, it's made me slightly more contemplative about the culture that I'm writing about. Mm-hmm. And I don't feel compelled to be the first person to have feelings about something. And there was a period, I would say, in like 2010, 2011, 2012, where I was definitely one of those people who would not infrequently run to Twitter to express a feeling about something. But now I don't really feel compelled to do that anymore. It makes me a little bit sad for myself. I liked having that energy. But now that energy is just gone to other places. I don't need to do that anymore.
What about in the discussion or review of a movie, addressing in the political climate that we find ourselves in, having to talk so much more about political implications or political inferences that you might normally not pick up on or give that much attention, but then it becomes a huge part of why you're talking about this movie because of what the world is going through. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, I think about this a lot. And initially I felt it, I mean, it's still necessary, but I felt it was like morally necessary because nobody was doing it. You know, there was a period in like 2009, 10, 11, maybe even before that, like in the mid 2000s, when you were discouraged from writing about the other things a movie is doing, a particular movie is doing. Those things having to do with certain identity issues that the movies aren't typically aware they're engaged in. The ways in which movies are racist and misogynist and homophobic and classist, and the way that that cluelessness about itself kind of speaks to a sort of national or historical cluelessness. That wasn't really where criticism was 10, even about 10 years ago. It started to change, I think, around the time of Barack Obama's election, I would say, where, you know, these other conversations that were happening outside of popular culture drifted into popular culture. And so you had all these questions about representation and depiction. Not that those things weren't true before, but they became more active elements of certain people's criticism. And then it just became like a central focus of a certain work's quality. And you'd have these, sometimes you couldn't really engage with the work itself because you had to engage with the stuff that previously was secondary to the nuts and bolts of the yays and nays of a particular work. And I think there's a whole generation of people writing about popular culture right now, particularly movies, who only focus on whether or not the thing under consideration is offensive. And that is not necessarily interesting to me. Mm. I prefer to incorporate its offensiveness into its other problems. If indeed the thing is offensive, or if the thing is great, but it also has this other problem.
Mm. More interesting conversation, isn't it?
Probably, only because, I don't know. It's like, so The Revenant, for instance, I don't know why my brain just went to that movie, but here we are. I feel like the way we talked about, first of all, we now hate Iñárritu. Now, I don't want to pat myself on the back for always not liking him, but I really always never liked him. But it's complicated because his movies are so pleasurable and they're so beautiful, and their handsomeness is the thing that's offensive to me, right? Like, this is a person who really fancies himself a socially aware, morally committed, humanist filmmaker. Mm-hmm. But he's not Satyajit Ray. He's like Michael Bay more than he is, you know, any of your typical humanist filmmakers. He's a better filmmaker than Michael Bay for the most part. But I do think that there was something honest about Birdman and The Revenant that said to me, okay, this is where this guy is. He only wants to make Hollywood movies. So like what you were putting up with a movie like Beautiful or
21 Grams.
I'm thinking particularly of Babel.
Did you hate that stuff immediately?
Oh yeah, I did. What do you mean? Like
when you saw it. As
I just
opposed
felt
to
like this. This is a. I mean, 21 Grams. I'm not. Amoros Perros, I think, is fantastic. I think that is the perfect wedding of his claim that he's a humanist, and his understanding in the belief that he's an artist as well. He just, at some point, he couldn't figure out how to balance his need to impress you with what a great filmmaker he is with his need to, like, morally assault you with what a good person he also was. And that balance just got totally out of whack, where what you were, to the point where, like, where you were watching the movies of a sort of grandiose vision. And I don't know, I never liked that. But I loved trying to balance how much I hated what he thought he was with how much I kind of enjoyed the movies, right? The movies are kind of enjoyable,
yeah, sure.
Which is part of what's wrong with them. I just don't think that sequence, that nightclub sequence in, well, there's two nightclub sequences. One is great. The one in Babel is great, where the Rinko Kikuchi character goes into the club and experiences that space through, I think the sound design is muffles her hearing. Is she blind or deaf? I can't remember now, but she experiences this nightclub through a heightened, it's a heightened sensory experience. Mm-hmm. He takes that sequence and redoes it in Beautiful with Javier Bardem going to a nightclub. And the nightclub is like, it's got, you know, I don't remember if he's high, but the filmmaking definitely is. And there are like people with like asses, like on their like asses for faces, and like a bunch of freaky stuff happens in this nightclub. And it's a great sequence, but it's like, you couldn't just make a movie about a poor person suffering. You had to like give us all of this like syrup and sugar and narcotic to make that plea on behalf of the suffering person palatable. Anyway, this is a long way of saying when the Revenant, like at some point he turns this corner and becomes like just a guy who wants to make Hollywood movies. And The Revenant is just like an old-fashioned Hollywood Western by a person who does not understand American history enough to know why this might be a problem for a lot of people. And you've acknowledged that Native peoples existed and this land is previously theirs, but they're just the same old nasty monsters that you pretty much get in any John Ford movie or a Bud Boddicker movie. And the way people responded to that was to just totally ignore how astoundingly good the filmmaking was and just attack him for perpetuating these stereotypes of American Westerns. That just kind of bored me. Because if you could have found a way to have this conversation about what was wrong with that movie while also acknowledging that part of the thing that he's trying to do is top those. I mean, it's just tough. Like a great criticism of Iñárritu and under the circumstances is really that his being full of shit, like this is exactly what I've been trying to tell you guys about this guy in like Babel and 21 Grams. He doesn't believe in any of this stuff and he doesn't really care about Native Americans. He just wants to make a great movie. And here's the proof. I don't know, there's a way to do that so that you acknowledge the one thing being true about his sense of artistry and the other thing that's true about that sense of artistry just kind of being appalling at the same time. But now I just feel like he's honest about what a shallow bullshitter he is. And I felt like Birdman was the beginning of this phase of his letting down the guard of his self-seriousness in a way. But we can't talk about that. All we really are talking about is just how racist The Revenant is. And how, like, why are we watching another movie about a white guy in native land whose story is more important than the native people? And I get that. That's a totally valid point. I just feel like there are a number of ways to have that conversation as opposed to just completely dismissing this movie out of hand.
Sure. And then to the other thing, though, that happens is the outrage over a trailer before the film even comes out, which exhausts me like you would not believe.
It's becoming its own thing.
No, it's a thing.
Trailer outrage. Think piece about the trailer from someone who probably would never watch it anyway and hasn't. Just the idea of a movie gets people's back up. What are your thoughts?
It's just, I don't know. It's just sad.
Do you ever want to write about a trailer?
It's exhausting.
I used to review trailers. It used to be one of the minor things when I was at Grantland. I mean, because trailers are, like a good trailer is pretty fun. Mm. I used to write about trailers very briefly, like a 100-word thing about a trailer. But to conclude, I don't know. The turn we took from just sort of saying, hey, this trailer has made me excited about this movie versus, hey, this trailer has made me. I feel like there are ways in which people don't understand what a trailer is supposed to do. It's a lie. It's telling you, it's lying about something. I mean, it basically is true, but it is also basically false. And the only way to find out what the truth is to go see the movie. That's the brilliance of a movie preview.
It's to pay your money, get your box of popcorn, and sit and watch it. Yeah.
But I'm also open to the idea that a side effect of that lie is that if the lie is offensive to people, they're free to speak about it. But the sort of damnation of an entire movie based on the trailer, I feel like you have to do your due diligence and be like, well, but I'll be back in, you know, 2 months or 6 months or a week or whatever to tell you that either I was wrong about this trailer that I said was probably for the worst movie ever made, or I was right. This movie's terrible. But that never, I don't think there's rarely a follow-up by the same person who shit on the trailer.
So Tully's coming out.
Mm-hmm.
A woman, a blogger, a mother, got very fired up about the trailer because it seemed to portray a certain kind of postpartum depression in a certain kind of disagreeable way, or didn't match her experience, or maybe trivialized her experience some way. She wrote a think piece on her blog about why she's not going to see the movie. So she's not going to see it, so the follow-up isn't coming.
Right.
The Times picked it up, and Diablo Cody had a, not a rebuttal necessarily, but she said, you know, it's supposed to be uncomfortable. It's not going to be
about
everybody.
Like, but this is the thing. Like, okay, so I'm lucky, right? Like, I get to go to movies for a living and write about, you know, I see a lot of movies. So, I mean, a lot of times, I should say, I don't know who's making these movies before I go see them. Like, I didn't know what Three Billboards was and who had made it or anything before I got to
it. In Bruges or whatever?
I mean, I knew who Martin McDonagh was. I didn't know he made the movie.
Oh.
I didn't know he made Three Billboards. There's no, I didn't know. There's no opening credits or anything.
Oh, all right.
All right.
It just kind of starts with her in front of, you know, she.
Oh, that's true. There aren't.
There are no credits. Mm. So I just thought it was a, like, bad Robert Benton movie. But sometimes you do know who's made these movies. And if I see just the makers of Juno, the exact makers of Juno are back with another movie starring people that the makers of Juno have worked with on other movies, I'm probably going to assume they're trying to get on my nerves. I'm probably going to assume they want me to run to Medium or whatever and, like, complain about how I'm just bent out of shape and I'm not going to go see this movie that tries to, like, take a dump on my postpartum experiences as a mother. I'm just, well, mission accomplished. Now people are going to go see why you won't be seeing this movie. Yeah.
And we're talking about it. And
right. I mean, I don't know. I just, we have simultaneously lost our senses of humor. We're losing them. We're losing our senses of humor. We really aren't good at practicing close readings of anything or practicing criticism, really. It's bad. I have not read this woman's piece, by the way. See, we are perpetuating problems. Like, I'm complaining about a piece of writing I have not read, but I will say that just the sentiment around writing about trailers, like, I will not be seeing this movie because I...
Yeah, my response is, well, fair enough. You don't
good
have
for
to.
You, but I feel like the problem is we are so sensitive about all this stuff that we actually aren't even experiencing anything. Culturally, right? Like, this woman has had an actual experience with something that isn't actually real, right? She would say that she doesn't need to see this movie, but she's kind of, I don't know, I can't say that she's writing about it as though she has seen it, but she is removing herself from being able to have a true legitimate conversation about what might actually be wrong with Tully by preemptively saying that she has a problem with Tully without having seen the movie. And that, to me, I mean, you were short-circuiting and also kind of cowardly wimping out of having other difficult conversations by preemptively saying, I'm too offended to even dignify the existence of X work by having a serious conversation about it. And that's kind of where we are. Like, we are afraid of difficult, weird and awkward conversations to some extent.
But it's also it can be the best way to get your take out there before anybody else's, if you have that net.
But is that a take? Well, that's all it is though, right? It's just a take. It is not actual criticism, because what are you practicing criticism on at that point?
Right.
I don't know.
So with I Feel Pretty.
Yeah.
Everybody got all fired up about that. And then the movie came out, and then everyone had there's still lots of takes.
Right.
But they're more reasoned and more...
Because they'd seen, the 8 people who saw the movie, like, actually saw
Ouch.
The movie. Sorry, Amy Schumer.
Ouch for I Feel Pretty.
Did you guys see it?
I did.
I didn't. He did.
There's some all right laughs.
Terrible.
Come on, Leslie, come on.
It's so bad. It's so bad. Really?
It is. I said it.
I laughed a few times.
There are a few laughs
in my President's State of the Union address. Like, it doesn't mean that the hell is not approaching the handbasket, or the handbasket isn't approaching. It's like, yes, it is true. There are some funny things in that movie.
I gotta take it where I can get it, Wesley. I can't. So I mean, a few laughs is sometimes all I can ask for in this life.
Thumbs up.
You have so many other outlets to get laughs if you need them. You should not be relying on Amy Schumer movies to do it. You can rely on Amy Schumer television to do it.
Okay, yeah,
and there's
of course.
A lot of that.
Sure.
And like one or two stand-up specials, I don't know. I just feel like if you're looking at her at your movies,
I don't like for the stand-up for a laugh, that much.
Well,
there's some uncomfortable stuff in there that I can't get past.
Well, I don't know. I just feel like I Feel Pretty is just not a hill you want to die on for your comedy, is it?
No.
Okay, good.
I don't want to die on it.
Right, but you'd like go to the hospital for it, like. What's your?
I'll get my knees capped.
I lose a leg. I will lose a leg on this hill for
another one.
That's deep.
I would like to know, being with the New York Times, you probably attract a bit of feedback if you happen to express an opinion. You know, maybe Amy Schumer wants to reach out after she listens to this because she's a fan.
No, what Amy Schumer has people do it on her behalf.
Oh, right, yeah. I want to know some interactions you've had, maybe that worked out. Started, you know, confrontational, but maybe you came to an understanding.
With readers or
people
who make the stuff?
People who make the stuff.
It does not happen very often.
Sure.
I've had people like things I've written that were positive about their work. Like, you're just never going to hear from, like, a whole class of people who might have read something you wrote. But just, you know, life is too short. Yeah. Like, this is they did their job, and then I did my job. And there isn't a lot to say about that unless the person feels like I got something egregiously wrong. And that's when I have heard other writers talk about how they've heard from the somebody involved with the production they've written about.
I feel like people talk about when they hear from a filmmaker, it's usually somebody who's a little bit like
upset.
Wants to pick a fight.
Yeah.
Doesn't mind picking a public fight.
Right. I mean, I've had that, like, you know, A.O. Scott, who I work with.
You don't call him Tony?
I do call him Tony, but I didn't. Yeah. I mean, if I said Tony Scott on this show, people might immediately assume I was talking about the late Tony Scott.
Right.
Because sometimes I have to, like, check myself before I address the other Tony Scott, my Tony Scott. But, you know, A.O. Scott reviews The Avengers in the New York Times, the first Avengers movie, and Samuel L. Jackson basically raises holy hell on behalf of the movie and more or less argues that Tony should lose his job.
Seems reasonable.
I mean, it also sort of, you know, like he questioned Tony's competence and I don't know, there's a way that the job of a critic is sort of misunderstood. I mean, because if you go back and read that review, there's nothing. There have been so many meaner things written about things Samuel L. Jackson has been in for much longer amount of screen time. I mean, he didn't write to anybody when The Caveman's Valentine came out. I mean, I just feel like, you know, he just all things in proportion, Mr. Jackson.
Yeah.
And but I actually don't know what was in his mind when he did that. But I don't have anything like that,
sure.
Really. I mean, I wrote this piece about Three Billboards when it came out, basically like months after it had been out for, you know, it had been out for maybe 3 months by the time I wrote my thing.
Sure. It was sort of in the Oscars, wasn't it?
Right. It wasn't a review. It was just more like, gosh, it's really strange how these people like this movie. Mm-hmm. And they like it because it's saying something about America that I don't think it is. So, I mean, basically, that's what I wrote. And it was pointed out to me that one of the people in the comment section of this piece was Sam Rockwell's father.
Oh, that's right. I remember seeing this. Yeah, that's right.
Now, funny story is, I haven't really talked about this very much, but, like, I used to work with Pete Rockwell's dad. I mean, with Sam Rockwell's dad, Pete.
Right.
who made this post about his son being very good in this movie. He didn't have a problem. I mean, he might have had a problem with what I wrote, but the gist of his comment that he left on the site was, "I love my son, and he's really good in this movie." And apparently he won an Academy Award for it. But I used to work with Pete at the San Francisco Chronicle. I never really met him, but he sent somebody out from the press room where he worked into the newsroom where I worked to tell me that he had a son named Sam and he was really proud of him. Aww. And I think I had reviewed maybe Charlie's Angels Full Throttle, okay, which he was in. I think I had written about the first Charlie's Angels movie, which I really liked a lot. I wonder if I would still feel that way if I saw it now, but I loved the first Charlie's Angels movie. And I think he wanted to let me know that one of the people in this movie that I liked a lot, including a person I actually identify in the review as enjoying a lot too, was Pete Rockwell's son. So he's been doing this. This is on brand for Mr. Rockwell is what I would say.
Been boosting him for years.
Oh, for years.
The thing about Three Billboards is one of my favorite things that you or anybody else has said in the last year, because I was so appalled by how terrible that movie was. I couldn't believe how much people liked it. And then it starts winning prizes. As much as I like everyone involved, except for maybe Martin McDonagh, I think rewatched In Bruges again recently.
Speaking my language, sir, keep going.
I think In Bruges is also secretly terrible.
That's a secret?
I think it is a secret. I think lots of people love it.
I mean, I don't begrudge those people loving it. I just don't like it.
I just thought that it's not about America, any real recognizable America. And he was like, he had never met Americans or been in America ever. But the other thing I liked that you wrote was more recently was about Bill Cosby.
Oh.
And
no, I mean, I'm right. Just
you're all right.
No, I'm not actually.
Didn't you write it?
But go on.
So we talk a lot about separating the art from the artist. I wonder what you think about that. And obviously, this is all very now, and it's fresh, and the wounds are all open. I just wonder, how does this play out? I don't want to ask anything horrendously suggestive about anything.
No, it's a tricky question. And there's no good answer. There's no one answer. The truth is nobody wants to talk about this. Yeah. Nobody. I mean, once you're talking about it, it's great to talk about, but the truth is nobody wants to talk about it because it's really uncomfortable and there's no answer. And it's hard to give up something that you love, that means something to you, that made you in some ways, some part of you, the person you are, or you've given that work some value that really does exist independent of the person who made it. I mean, there are ways in which the person who made it is inextricable from what you like about it, but you don't necessarily like it only because that person made it. It exists only because that person made it in a lot of cases. But anyway, Lori Moore, I'm having this conversation with her and I bring this up with her, and she explains her feelings about Woody Allen's Manhattan and what about it is a problem for her. And she also says that, you know, it'd be a lot easier. This would be a lot more difficult for Woody Allen people if Woody Allen's late career work, we all know that it had come in waves, and mm-hmm. there'd be a period where you'd get three in a row that were almost better than good. And so, you know, you'd have to sort of reevaluate. Well, maybe he still does have it. But her argument was that it's much easier to to begin to have these Woody Allen divorce questions because the work just isn't worth dying on a hill over.
Right.
And to her larger sort of philosophical and moral concern, because I mean, the reason I brought it up was because in her literary criticism, I just noticed that she is very patient with novelists whose depictions of women are loaded, maybe chauvinistic at best and misogynistic at worst. Mm-hmm. And these are criticisms that she would have of a particular work, but they don't damn all of the work, right? Like, she's very good about writing about misogyny and Philip Roth while also understanding that you can carve out a space around the misogyny to appreciate what else is great about something like Sabbath's Theater, which is, you know, I think one of his two or three greatest books. So this question of being at the top of your game while also being at the bottom of the humanity barrel is really interesting. So I know I'm supposed to be answering a Bill Cosby question, but But I'm thinking more about like somebody like R. Kelly, mm-hmm. right? Who, I mean, R. Kelly has honestly musically never sucked. The level at, I mean, I see you making a face, but even the thing that you're probably thinking about is better than you remember it being.
All right, I'll go with you.
And let's just sort of setting aside what I'm, all right, okay. This is a person who could at any minute be at the top of his game in a recording studio. And, you know, he's put out a couple of albums in the last 5 years that I think are like some of his best recordings. And he operates in many different veins. He became useful to white people as a sort of kitsch specialist. The Trapped in the Closet thing, I think, introduced him to an audience of people who didn't have any musical use for R. Kelly and thought he was a joke. Then there are people who just, for whom, many of all races, who for whom R. Kelly is sort of ambient pop music that addresses some aspect of their childhood, adolescence, early adulthood, et cetera. But part of the reason that it's hard, this R. Kelly question, one of the problems is that the music is still a part of our lives, right? Like, you go to any club that has an interesting DJ and you're likely to hear to any number of like 8 R. Kelly songs. And I got to a point where I had to start leaving the dance floor because I love Fiesta. I can't do it. He's allegedly done horrible things to a lot of women. And one of the reasons that it's been hard to talk about is not only that he's still so omnipresent in people's lives, it's also that like the things he did to black women, and who it took a long time to get a groundswell of advocacy for. But now it seems like we're reaching a critical mass again. And so the question is, what do we do with this guy? What do we do with his music? I mean, his tours are being canceled. I think there is something about what is happening right now with men who do horrible things to other people. There's no excuse for us as consumers of that work not to think about what we're consuming. It isn't to say that you can't listen to an R. Kelly song, but you just have to be aware of everything your body is moving to when your body is moving to it. And I think the awareness counts for something. It's kind of like eating meat in a lot of ways. You know, it's you know what that used to be. And so you make this choice. You make this choice to continue to eat it because it's good. In some ways it's good for you, but it used to be, you know, I mean, there's a process that
A very unpleasant process.
Right, that got you your food. Mm. And if we can reckon with that and like still, you know.
There's some kind of moral bankruptcy in making the choice, making that evaluation.
No.
Like, I eat meat and I, yeah.
It's just part of being human. I mean, I think just even having the conversation and acknowledging that there's a problem in the first place, it just makes you human. Like, we're really advanced creatures. We're good at compartmentalizing. I think you can keep the two experiences in your brain. You know that this thing that you're experiencing was made by a bad person. And in some ways, the bad people sort of make it, like, you know, if not like a Harvey Weinstein, where Harvey Weinstein was a facilitator of Art We Get. But if you're like a Bill Cosby or an R. Kelly or Roman Polanski or Woody Allen or, you know, God forbid, a James Toback, who, you know, that's the easiest one in the world. It was good riddance before we knew how awful he was as a human being. Because the awfulness, my point was really that the awfulness is in the work. The James Toback is basically making a movie about what an awful human being he is and having not James Toback embody that awfulness so that it seems palatable in some way. But I don't know. I feel like we are capable of having both these. It's okay to carry both things. I mean, and if people want to just never watch another episode of The Cosby Show or A Different World, fine. That is a choice that you are making, and I support that choice. But I don't think it has to be categorical, and it doesn't have to be absolute, and it doesn't have to be unanimous. I think you can hold an awareness that he did these things to these women in your brain while also understanding that there's incredible value in his television.
Do you see a time in, I don't know when, but when you read the thing that says, I just rewatched The Cosby Show and it's still really good?
Oh, that's easy to write though, right? Like that's an easy thing to write. The thing that you can't write is, I just rewatched The Cosby Show and I now have the keys of understanding that Bill Cosby didn't do it, right? I mean, that's a totally different thing. The Cosby Show has nothing to do. I mean, the thing that I wrote about The Cosby Show, the thing that makes me so angry, is that The Cosby Show basically exists to exonerate bad Bill. Right? The Cosby Show basically is an invention to make impossible to believe that this other person, and I don't even want to make it, I don't want to be that cynical about it. I actually think it's more psychological than that. I think The Cosby Show needed to exist for Bill Cosby to continue to function in the world. I think that he is pathologically, he's ill. And I think that part of working out this illness was to imagine what it would be like to just play a saint. Mm. You know what I mean? It's not like in the movies before, like in the 70s, he was playing Bill. He wasn't playing Cliff Huxtable.
Right. Yeah.
He was a dirty dog in the 70s.
Yeah.
He was talking about drugging women in these movies. Yeah. He was like having sex with multiple women in these movies. This wasn't like Cliff Huxtable is a like a cry for help in a weird way.
Right,
you know,
right.
We just didn't know because we just assumed that like that Bill Cosby just invented itself in 1983.
Right.
But anybody who was around during the 1970s, I think The Cosby Show was weird for them, you know?
Right.
I think the comedy albums made it easier, but anyway, I don't know. This is a million different ways to be thinking about these people and the work that they make. But I think it's totally fine to be watching The Cosby Show.
Well, it's a bit tricky to find at the moment.
Well, yeah. Oh, yes. Also, good luck with that.
Well, look, this has been delightful. I will ask you, we always ask our guests what they've been watching lately, and I dare say you've been watching a bit. Loving, hating?
Atlanta. I love Atlanta.
Yeah.
Atlanta's just great.
Great show.
Excellent.
Is that on? That's on here, right?
It is on our channel.
On SBS.
Okay.
Atlanta's great. There's a Grace Jones documentary that I like a lot.
Yeah, I've not seen
that. You wrote about that, didn't
you? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did Bloodlight and Bommy is what it's called.
You're just a big Grace
documentary.
Jones fan.
I love Grace Jones. Grace Jones is kind of the be-all, end-all. She's great. I like Ready Player One more than I thought I was going to.
Really?
I did. I really liked it.
Uh-oh. Here we go.
I just really like how it's not a dystopia. It's the thing that comes after dystopia. It's the thing where, like, humanity learns to live with this thing that it's become as a result of a cataclysm. I don't know what I'm sure there's a science fiction term for that experience, but I just like that he keeps trying to find ways to entertain himself without boring us. I mean, maybe that didn't happen for you. Maybe you were bored by this, but I get a lot of pleasure from a person who really could have a sense of self-seriousness that results in his making something like a bad version of The Post every year.
Right,
but instead, sure. he, I mean...
Yeah, you're right.
I don't know. I just really like how excited he is by making movies that don't also feel... I mean, they're kind of responding to marketplace concerns, but in a weird way, they're responding to marketplace concerns that he invented. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, this marketplace is of his making. So he's just at home in these kind of, like, expensive, like, pretty successful, artistically pretty successful movies. Mm. I don't know why I brought up Ready Player One. I was just surprised I liked it as much as I did.
Well, Wesley Morris, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you
so much for
thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, that was Wesley Morris.
It was fantastic talking to him. Special thanks to him and the Sydney Writers Festival. Please make sure you go on to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review, a bunch of stars, say a lot of nice things. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter at SBS Movies. Our producer is Jeremy Wilmot and Dan Barrett sometimes. I'm on Twitter at Nick Bassine, and Fiona is at Anything But Fifi. See you next time.